Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session. Restore to adjournment.
You may be seated. First case on our calendar is 001145, Bernadine Davis, Executrix versus Walmart Stores. Mr. Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. Let me start with some points on which all parties agree. That's first of all, spoliation of evidence is wrong, it's immoral, and the judicial system cannot tolerate it. Second, there are existing records for spoliation of evidence that all parties agree may be used, in fact, were used in this case. One, an individual can draw an adverse inference in light of the evidence. Two, there are discovery sanctions, including, for example, prejudgment interest, which was awarded in this case. And three, ultimately, there, of course, is a fraud on the court remedy. When there's actual fraud, a judgment can be vacated. What's at issue in this case, and where the parties do disagree, is whether a claimant can use these spoliation remedies in an initial case, as the plaintiff did here, and then bring a separate freestanding spoliation tort in a second case. And that's what we think is mistaken and what is not supported by the law of this court. The key exhibit in both complaints in this action, the original underlying wrongful death case and this spoliation case, was the so-called Exhibit A. In fact, if you look at our supplement to their second complaint, the spoliation tort complaint, they attached just one exhibit. What is it? It's Exhibit A. Then if you look, read the complaint, you'll see the cornerstone, the key component of their spoliation claim is again, Exhibit A. Exhibit A gave plaintiffs everything they could ever have wanted when it came to trying to get the punitive damages remedy they are now seeking.
Mr. Sutton, on that point, I read your brief thoroughly, and frankly, when I finished with it, I thought, yeah, this makes sense. Res judicata, clearly Exhibit A was used, and we know the facts that you're about to give us. We know all those facts that was used in the first trial and all. And I thought, this ought to be an easy case. I then read the other brief. And what I find in the other brief is Exhibit A is not the only thing that was secreted. The legal diary was an important element. And I went back through your brief. No place can I see you make any reference to the legal diary, which was found at a later time, as I recall it, in the prejudgment interest discovery. Now, why would you just ignore that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, that's the claims file, which, of course, is attorney-client privilege and couldn't be brought. That's point one. Point two, that, if you look at that, why don't we look at that? Everyone before may want to look at it. If you look at their brief, page five, this is what Justice Douglas is referring to, it's the bottom of page five, and read these notes. And ask yourself, what does this say? And first of all, is this really spoliation of evidence? But it's the reference to Judy Bunch, who was the assistant who had typed Exhibit A. And it says, she informed, here the attorney, those are the initials, Brad, Karen, BLK, that she calls the clubs one time per week for a loss prevention update. Various clubs informed her that the dock was potentially dangerous. She informed Nick Shepard, Director Sam's loss prevention. And then that was one of the reasons for Exhibit A. In other words, there were incidents. Now, what were the weekly reports she was referring to? And this is, of course, the discovery problem in the case. The original discovery request, and again, let's look at Appellate's brief, page 3, it's at the top of page 3. Their complaint is that when they made this document request...
You're talking about Appellee's brief, not Appellant.
Appellee's brief, you mean.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Appellee's brief.
Because you don't mention it. Anything but Exhibit A. You don't mention any of this.
And, Your Honor, I don't think I needed to. The whole point of spoliation of evidence is this. If an individual does what plaintiffs have claimed Walmart did, which is suppress evidence they should have produced, what is the common law adverse inference that can be drawn? The adverse inference is that you knew there were prior incidents and you suppressed them in bad faith because you were afraid you were going to get caught. That's all they needed, not only to win their wrongful death claim, that's all they needed for the punitive damages claim and for their survivor claim.
Or maybe that your client was afraid to have all that go before the jury. Forget the legal diary. I think that's what's called the legal diary.
Yes.
Go to the, what was it, 32 incident reports? When they asked for all this in discovery, and you never gave any of it. Your client did. I recognize you didn't try the case.
That's the point I was just about to get to, Your Honor. And again, I misspoke. It's Appellee's brief, top of page 3.
Mm-hmm.
The second request was any and all reports of accidents or injuries occurring on the loading docks at Sam's Club. Now, what was found out at the prejudgment interest stage and what agitated plaintiffs in the lower courts was the fact that Walmart does keep weekly reports of all accidents and incidents in Walmart stores and Sam's Clubs.
And denied that it had any of those.
Well, that, of course, wasn't asked for. What was asked for was loading dock. Now, Justice Douglas, I'm not defending you. I'm agreeing with you that as a matter of discovery law, Rule 37, this should have been produced. And so did the legal Walmart's attorney at the prejudgment interest stage. He said, in retrospect, we should have produced those weekly reports. But I don't think, Your Honor, that's spoliation. What happened was you had a situation where, yes, they've got these reports. They're primarily about customer accidents in the stores. And then, of course, people slip on this or that. And what they should have done is they should have taken those reports and given them all, everything pre-1992, to plaintiffs and let plaintiffs look through them to find out if there were anything relating to loading dock accidents or incidents.
Okay, I might agree it's not spoliation, but it's clearly Moskowitz. That's exactly what I wrote Moskowitz. It was unbelievable what we found in that record, even stuff we couldn't put in the opinion, where the doctor had changed his records and blamed the injury to the patient on the patient as opposed to the doctor. Now, you know, this isn't supposed to be trial by ambush. That's why we have rules.
Your Honor, I could not agree more with you, and that's why Walmart did agree at the prejudgment interest stage. They should have been more fulsome in their answers to this, but I must respectfully disagree with the point you just made, and that's that this is Moskowitz. It's not, Your Honor, and I know you wrote it, and of course your opinion of it is more important than mine, but Moskowitz was about...
Only for the moment.
It's about what a doctor went back and changed his notes. I mean, for a very obvious reason. He realized this person had cancer, ultimately died from cancer, and he then tried to put the blame on her for not getting a biopsy, which was outrageous. This wasn't changing notes. This wasn't changing any document. In fact, the best they've got here is civil perjury. I mean, that's the most you can say.
Is there a difference between the crime of commission as opposed to omission with discovery?
Well, when it comes to...
We aren't going to lie. We just aren't going to give it to you.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a problem, but I think you disagreement with me that this is not spoliation. I mean, that was, at most, a Rule 37 sanction problem, for which they were punished. I mean, $600,000 of prejudgment interest they had discovered in the prejudgment stage. They had the claims files turned over, as Moskowitz requires. They got just what they wanted. Now, if they thought they had a spoliation claim and they could get Moskowitz punitive damages claim, you can't have two bites at the apple at that stage. They should have said, no, Your Honor, we want prejudgment interest. We deserve prejudgment interest. Why? Walmart didn't settle when they should have settled. They could have still sought, but they would have gotten prejudgment interest on that ground. They didn't do it. They instead said, we're going to turn this into a spoliation-type prejudgment interest hearing. They had abundant discovery on it. They had a hearing on it. And then they got it. And now they're saying we can have a freestanding tort. But let me give you the best reason.
In that prejudgment interest hearing, did they know then about Exhibit A?
Yes, Your Honor.
So Exhibit A already was on the table at that time. Was Exhibit A on the table at the time during the trial itself?
It was not only on the table, Your Honor, at the time of the trial. Plaintiffs, I would say that they, you know, not as clean as they could have been here. They not only had Exhibit A at the time of the trial. They had it before their complaint. What did they do in
discovery? But that's really not the issue. I mean, we know that they found that the plaintiff found Exhibit A by its own investigation because in a deposition there was denial that there was any such document. But isn't the plaintiff's argument that, and I'm not, I want to make sure I understand it, that yeah, we had Exhibit A, but Exhibit A was only enough to get us intentional tort recovery. It was not enough for punitive damages. And that had we known about the legal team diary, we probably would have had enough for punitive damages, and we would have then done what Moskowitz says. We would have filed for punitive damages. But isn't that the spoliation? Is that if we had, plaintiff is saying, if we had known about the extent to which Walmart personnel checked on the pullaways, I mean, it was every week or every regular telephone calls.
Not on the pullaways, on accidents in Walmart stores.
Okay, loss prevention update, right. And that was as you do in your brief, you have the discussion between the attorney and I guess it's Shed Shepherd, where he acts like he doesn't know any of this during the trial, and obviously he does, because it was his memo, I guess. I mean, at least that's the argument. Isn't that the spoliation? Isn't that the issue, whether the plaintiff had enough information going into the when they filed their complaint for the intentional tort case to see this as a punitive damages case?
Your Honor, that's one of our main points here. One of our main points is Exhibit A alone was enough to get you that punitive damages. Why is that? Because in the common law since the 17th century, when you don't produce evidence, you suppress it, or as in Moskowitz, actually try to rewrite it and change it, you get to draw an adverse inference against the party who's found to have done that. The minute they had Exhibit A, they had a punitive damages claim for the underlying tort and for spoliation. End of story. They had it right then. I mean, they didn't even need to bring a spoliation claim in light of the adverse inference. They could have brought punitive damages and said, this failure to produce Exhibit A proves there were incidents, quote unquote, of prior pullaways. You knew about them. They were dangerous. You did nothing about them. In fact, I think if you look at the so-called, you know, smoking guns that were discovered at the prejudgment interest stage, you don't find anything different. Just the fact that there were incidents. Just someone did testify at trial, there were incidents. And then at prejudgment, they got the notes indicating that once a week, Judy Bunch made phone calls to the Sam's Club stores, found out about all accidents, which would include loading dock incidents, and that's how they got those reports. But here's what I think the greatest risk is of recognizing this claim in the setting. It's not just one that plaintiffs can use. It's one that any defendant worth their salt would set up. It's a perfect insurance policy. Engage in broad discovery and save your punches on four or five lines of inquiry. Don't go all the way down the road. Why should you? Wait to see if you lose the case. And then if you lose the case, what do? You bring a spoliation claim against the plaintiff. And what are your damages?
Yeah, but that's putting the burden on the party that's not the wrongdoer, isn't it? I mean, we've got one party who clearly kept documents from the other, and your argument is, well, the other party should have been more aggressive, I guess, in determining that the second party was lying to them.
No, Your Honor, there's always fraud in the courtroom. In other words, as we said in our brief, and it's always true, if what they've done, what Walmart has done, amounts to fraud in the court, suppression of evidence, you vacate the judgment and you start anew. You vacate the judgment whether they won, you vacate the judgment whether they lost. So there's always a remedy. Plus, not to say prejudgment interest, if this case shows, you can get remedy prejudgment interest or discovery sanctions.
You make the argument, the Grava v. Parkman argument, that this case, that this sets up a scenario where Grava would control in terms of it being a claim that was
known
or reasonably should have been known.
Yes.
Would you address that for a minute? Because that's separate. I think that maybe is more global. It could decide the matter aside from. The Exhibit A is enough to get you to maybe to the Grava v. Parkman.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And the reason Exhibit A was enough for plaintiffs reasonably to have known they had a spoliation claim was the fact that it referred to these incidents. In other words, it was, as they said, the only reason they could bring this claim, the existence of Exhibit A. Walmart doesn't produce it. If everything else they're calling, they're saying is spoliation, surely the failure to produce Exhibit A was spoliation. So that would be a classic gravel situation. The second issue presented in this case, which I want to get to briefly, is that the states are not following this separate spoliation tort. California has since changed its mind. This court was created in 1984 in a Smith case in California. Ohio adopted it briefly. New Mexico's adopted it. Alaska and the state Supreme Court decisions. Since Smith, that's it. They're all changing their mind. New Jersey doesn't even have that anymore. This is very much a minority view, and the reason California changed its mind, I see my time's up now.
Just finish your thought quickly.
And the reason California, and I think these other courts have changed their mind, is there are adequate other remedies to remediate this kind of problem, and you've got the risk that plaintiffs and defendants alike can set these claims up in the course of the underlying case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton. Mr. Eisen.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm here today on behalf of Bernadine Davis, the widow of Tom Davis, in order to stand up for the principle that those who intentionally destroy or conceal evidence in litigation ought to be punished whenever that conduct is discovered.
Guys, we know all of the facts and we know how egregious you say they are, and maybe they are. I want to go right to the law. Why are you here? You won in the Court of Appeals, and yet your memorandum in support of jurisdiction urged us to take this case. What is the difference in your mind between Moskowitz and spoliation?
The difference between Moskowitz and spoliation?
Well, because what you really argued, as I remembered your jurisdictional memorandum, is that you wanted this court to say that this was a Moskowitz extension, not a spoliation case. Why?
Your Honor,
what more do you get than you already have under the Court of Appeals a trial on this issue?
I think the chief difference is that the fundamental underlying message of the Moskowitz decision is cheaters never prosper. Not necessarily so under Smith versus Howard Johnson and the spoliation rubric. In Smith versus Howard Johnson, under that rubric, a plaintiff is required to prove that she or he or she was injured as a result of the spoliation itself.
But what are the other elements of the tort?
Well, the key elements is pending or probable litigation. The alleged spoliator needs to know pending or probable litigation. Destruction or concealment of evidence. Disruption to the plaintiff's case. Actually has to be done with the intent to disrupt the plaintiff's case. Then actual disruption of the plaintiff's case. And damages.
And so in that, one of those elements is the pending litigation and how did you term it, the knowledge of an evidence not being put forth, not being disclosed, the non-disclosure element, right? What'd you call it? Say the element again, besides
the
pending.
Destruction, alteration,
yeah,
concealment
okay.
of evidence, design.
Concealment would work here. So in that, in as much as you had, your client had at the time of trial, surely knowledge of pending litigation, you're there, and concealment of a document. So if those key elements of the tort are in place at the time you're trying the case, doesn't Grava impact your ability to bring this action separately from the main case?
First, Your Honor, I would reject the underlying assumption that we had everything we needed. This case is not about exhibiting as much as Walmart would like it to be. It's about quite a bit more than that. Exhibit A is merely the tip of the iceberg.
It may be in terms of damages it could be more, but Exhibit A is important, is it not? Because that's the information the plaintiff has that says there's been a withholding of information that we as plaintiffs should have. There's been a deposition and, you know, it wasn't whatever, lie or whatever. But we didn't have some information we ought to have. And the argument, as you know, then is that, yeah, there's more information you should have had, the diary. But in terms of pleading and how you set up your intentional tort case, why wouldn't you plead punitive damages if you see the company has withheld information that appears to be an impediment to your claim? Isn't that the issue, at least the first issue?
If this case that we were here about today was here to complain solely about withholding of Exhibit A, I suppose you would be correct. But at the time of trial, all we knew was that they withheld from us Exhibit A, nothing more. What we found out after trial was not just the legal team diary, so we're not relying on a privileged document. What we found out was Judy Bunch, who swore under oath she knew nothing of prior premature poise, made notes, got
phone calls. But the important thing is, from a standpoint of legal analysis, what's so much more significant about that? This was worse than we thought. You know, not only did they withhold Exhibit A, but they had notes. Isn't it essentially the same thing? It's just it's just worse, but it's the same tort, the same withholding, the same concealment. It's just more of it.
I think it is the same immoral conduct. I don't think it's the same tort for several reasons. First of all, with respect to Exhibit A itself, had we done what you would propose, that is to say, ask for Moskowitz damages at trial based on Exhibit A, I think it's almost inevitable we would have failed. What at that point was our proof it was done intentionally? All we could do was argue, hey, look, this refers to premature pullaways. Our client died from a premature pullaway. It must have been intentional. That's the very best we could do. And we had nothing to counter the evidence Walmart put on and the arguments Walmart put on. We weren't hiding anything. It was an accident. It happened all by accident. That's how it turned over. Lo and behold, in prejudgment interest proceedings, we find out Judy Bunch wasn't merely a typist, but she had actual knowledge of actual premature pullaways and wrote it down and made notes.
And you therefore received a fairly large award for prejudgment interest because you had that information.
Well, I think it's not a fairly large award, it's a statutory interest rate.
Sure.
And if the argument is essentially, GU already received money because Walmart cheated, I suppose in part that's true. But punitive damages are designed to punish and deter. A statutory prejudgment interest award hardly punishes and deters the conduct of a fox.
Yes. Civil action, that's the purpose of prejudgment, is to say you should have done this and you didn't.
I think the purpose of the prejudgment interest award is really to continue to make the plaintiff whole. It isn't to punish.
If both sides operate in good faith, you don't get prejudgment. If both sides agree to punish themselves, you don't get prejudgment. It's designed
see how
to ensure
keep that up.
Bad faith action on one side. You found bad faith action, and you got an award.
Well,
and now you want more for the same action.
What we want is for Walmart to be punished and deterred. We want them to be subject to what they would have been subject to had they not been so very good at concealing their deceit.
I see a distinction. If you had all of this information at the time of trial, couldn't you have sought punitive damages as well as prejudgment interest? They're distinct. If you had all this information.
Your Honor, if we knew at the time of trial that Judy Bunch had taken notes about premature pullaways and destroyed them, you betcha, we would have asked for punitive damage under Moskowitz. Our ability to do that was thwarted by Walmart's intentional conduct in keeping it secret, and we're asking that we be permitted to continue
that. And then after that, you could have also sought prejudgment interest.
Absolutely.
You said that she destroyed the notes. Do you know that for sure? The reason I'm asking you is because do you read Smith the way I read it, that the elements of the spoliation claim are in the conjunctive rather than the disjunctive? In other words, you have to have every one of the elements to have a spoliation claim.
I believe that is correct.
All right, and the third one is willful destruction of evidence by defendant designed to disrupt the plaintiff's case. I thought you'd fail on a spoliation case just on that one. Can you show willful destruction of evidence by the defendant?
Well, we are at the summary judgment stage. We believe we will be able to prove that. What we do have, and that's where Exhibit A does come into play, because it will be a piece of evidence. The fact that Walmart hid from us Exhibit A tends to help support an inference that when it comes to Judy Bunch's notes, they were destroyed intentionally. In addition, we have Judy Bunch's very own testimony. First, we would argue perjured testimony. I knew nothing of premature pullaways. And subsequently, she admits that testimony could not have been correct.
Well, if you can show all of that, then you meet all the elements, it looks like to me, for the spoliation claim.
I think you're getting back to the initial question that you
asked.
Yeah, I am. You have an opportunity to answer.
I think it needs to be answered.
And you're right. You're right. What are we saying today? And why is this a Moskowitz case rather than Smith versus Howard Johnson? What do we get out of it? And the answer is, and the reason I think it's important for this court to hear this case, is because under Smith you have to prove your case was actually disrupted. We might have to go into court and show that but for this spoliated evidence, instead of X verdict, we would have had Y verdict, Y being greater than X. And under Moskowitz, that's not required and ought not to be. Required.
Well, could you, under Howard Johnson's case, simply present to the jury to stay away from the award of damages for the fact that you were the worst to acknowledge that you got $2 million and you're not to relitigate that? The jury made its determination as to the proper compensation for the wrong, the loss of life, and whether or not a judge lets in prejudgment interest, but simply focus on the fact that we had the way our case was disrupted is if you could set forth the and not focus on the underlying cases.
The answer, Your Honor, is yes, and if you look closely at our complaint, we essentially say that. So I'm not here conceding, I'm not saying.
But isn't that possible under what the Court of Appeals has already given us?
Yes. I think the answer to that is yes. I don't know if the Court of Appeals addressed that specifically, but we're not here today saying we have to go only under Smith versus Howard Johnson to lose. In fact, we intend to go to trial and prove that our case was, in fact, disrupted. We had to hire a safety expert we might not have had to hire. We may well be able to argue that. But what I'm saying is we're asking this court to say you don't have to prove that.
Well, are you asking this court to put the case in a posture where the next jury wouldn't even know there was a $2 million award on the underlying wrongful death? Is that what?
That is certainly something that this court could do and would be consistent with what this court said in Moskowitz.
Do you think that's fair?
Well, it is honestly something I hadn't considered. It isn't what we were asking this court to do in this case. But I do think it's fair, because when you cheat in litigation, there needs to be consequences regardless when you're caught. In this case, there were no consequences for the destruction of Judy Bunch's notes, or for the fact that the lawyer from Walmart sent Nick Shepard and Judy Bunch out to testify that these incidents may never have happened, only minutes before having been told that they did happen. None of that has been punished. So it would be fair to put the case in this posture, but what we're actually asking this court to do is to not give Walmart the reward it seeks, that is to say, immunity for punitive damages, to affirm the 8th District's opinion, to send it back to the court with instructions that if a jury finds that Walmart intentionally destroyed evidence with the purpose of attempting to avoid liability for Tom Davis' death, that the jury must award at least nominal damages and then may proceed to consider the question of punitive damages. If, in addition, we can show disruption to the plaintiff's case under Smith, we would be entitled to additional compensatory damages. But we're asking this court to say we need not, because if this were under Moskowitz, we wouldn't have to. No separate compensable harm need be shown.
Let me try one more time, and I don't mean to be badgering you any more than I did Mr. Sutton, for whom I have great respect, as well as you. Don't you fit into every element of the spoliation case? Now, the one you're concerned about is the fourth element, disruption of the plaintiff's case. Wasn't your case disrupted at the original trial on the basis that you didn't have the information that you sought discovery for?
Absolutely it was, Your Honor.
So whether we decided under Moskowitz or spoliation, unless we find res judicata...
In this case, you're right.
Oh,
but in other cases where a plaintiff may not be able to show that disruption,
yeah.
Why should the defendant who cheats benefit and force you out of Moskowitz into a higher burden under Smith? Here we think we can meet the burden, but why should a defendant benefit from its cheating and force a litigant who was cheated out of what it's entitled to under Moskowitz and into a much more...
What's the higher burden again under Smith?
Well, the fact in Smith that you must prove your case was actually disruptive. Easy to do, or a lot easier to do, when you lose at trial due to cheating. In this case, we were fortunate to win the case below, notwithstanding the cheating. So in our case, yeah, we intend to go back to the court. May I finish answering?
You may. I have a question for you.
Thank you. We intend to go back to the court and prove our compensatory damages under Smith. But we'd like the jury to be told you don't have to. If you can't make the verdict in this case or another litigant in another case, you're entitled to the Moskowitz damages.
I think there's a bit of a circular argument. You aren't arguing that you would have gotten more compensatory damages for the death.
From something else. If you would have had this information, the punitive damages rise from the fact that they knew of all of these incidents, etc. It isn't simply the fact they withheld, is it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there can be punitive damages in an intentional tort case.
Yes, that's what I'm
sure.
That's what I'm saying.
Exactly.
If you would have had all this information,
you're right.
You would have sought punitive damages.
Right, and frankly, I think it could be the case that we would have gotten a larger compensatory award. It may have been the result of punitive damages for that, as opposed to punitive damages for the destruction of evidence itself.
Let me ask you a different question, Mr. Eisen. Mr. Sutton has informed us that this is the spoliation claim is a distinct minority view in the country, in the jurisdictions in the country, and that there are other ways to say to witnesses, we don't want you to lie in court or in depositions or wherever. What's your response to that?
First of all, with respect to the position that it's a minority view, Mr. Sutton spoke of the California experience foremost, because they were the leader in adopting this tort in the first place. But what the actual California experience is quite different from what Mr. Sutton says it is. The fact is, in California, the tort is alive and well, where you don't know of the spoliated evidence at the time of the trial. In the Cedars-Sinai case cited by Mr. Sutton, the California court made very clear, in instances where you don't learn of the spoliated evidence at trial, the tort is still alive. And in this case, that's what happened with Judy Bunch's notes. The second thing is, all the other remedies in the world, adverse instructions, discovery sanctions, don't help in this case especially, because we couldn't have asked for them based on the destruction of Judy Bunch's notes, because we didn't know about that until after trial.
Well, the remedy could come after trial, I guess, if there was such a remedy, could it not?
In the case of an adverse evidence instruction, not really.
That would be right.
But what definitely can come after trial is Moskovitz's punitive damages that we would have been entitled to before. And that's what we're asking this court to do.
If we were to affirm this case, what syllabus, maybe you haven't, if you hadn't had a chance to think about a syllabus because you're the appellee, maybe you haven't, but what syllabus would you have us write? We have all the principles of res judicata. We're trying to fit cases into those principles. What's new? What new principle of law is in this case, in your view?
Well, in some ways it's not new, because I think we fit well under the established doctrine of res judicata. But I think I would have this court write something along the lines of punitive damages available at trial under Moskovitz versus Mount Sinai Medical Center for the alteration or destruction of evidence remain available after trial where the acts of alteration or destruction are successfully concealed until after trial. After all, in Brava, if you're only barred from bringing those things you could have brought, and if you don't know about it until afterwards, you could not have brought it.
Thank you, Mr. Eisen. Mr. Sutton, you've had no more time, but Mr. Eisen went over quite a bit, so take a minute. Start with a minute, see what you do with that.
Let me try to make some quick points. Justice Rutherford, I want to respond to your point. They clearly outrun notice with the Exhibit A problem to either bring punitive damages claim under their survivor claim or separately for spoliation. I think your point is that that claim could have been hurt by the fact that they suppressed still other evidence. That's exactly where a fraud on the court remedy comes into play, and that's exactly why counsel for plaintiff is correct. Even in California, if you engage in spoliation, you can still have a claim, but it's called fraud on the court. It's under Chambers versus Nasco, U.S. Supreme Court. This court recognizes that what you do is you vacate the judgment, you start anew, and again, cheaters don't prosper. You get a new claim, and if he thinks he can get more, that's just what he can do. No court in the country has ever, there's no reported case we have found or one he has found where they've used spoliation in the first claim and then brought a separate freestanding claim, a separate case, without vacating the first judgment. Now, I can explain, there's no better proof of this race judicata claim than pages 26 and 27 of the appellant supplement. I can read you his closing argument in the first trial, and this will be his closing argument in the second trial. Ladies and gentlemen, you can send a message down to Arkansas to Walmart, because the only thing they understand is money. We need to teach them they don't lie to us, don't rebuff us, tell us the truth. Maybe they'll learn something. In this paragraph, I'm asking you to take an opportunity, do something that I think could be one of the most important things any of us have ever done, and that is make a difference and send a message that you won't tolerate, quotes, I don't know who did this, I don't know who promulgated the policies, I don't know about these fire accidents, I don't know what they involved, I don't know about the fire pullaways, we don't know anything. That was his closing argument in the first case. It would be his closing argument in the second case. No court in the country has ever allowed these types of two bites of the apple. And if this court does, I can promise you, defendants will be doing the same thing every time they lose a judgment. They'll be setting up spoliation claims, and they'll come back, and they'll recover their judgment because it turned out this was just suppressed evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sutton. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.